213 area, 337-7947. Bill Crawford. He's the man that puts on the convention, and either he or his wife should be there to the phone and have the answers for you.
Okay. And the banquet is extra, right? You don't get that free
No, that is not included in the membership, but tickets, of course, will be available right up to the last minute.
It's going to be worth it, I think. As I told Bob Locke before we began, I'm going to be one of the people who's sitting there doing to him what he has done to so many in science fiction. And I'm looking forward to it. And I did a lot of research on you, and it was easy to get. You are a very well-written up person in science fiction and fantasy annals. There is the Paul Walker's book, Speaking of Science Fiction, which is a collection of interviews with writers. There is, as I mentioned before, All Our Yesterday by Harry Warner, and a number of other things. You're in Alternate Worlds, James Gunn's book in the visual history, science fiction, etc. And I sort of want to go through the career, and I want to begin with a very fascinating figure that we don't know too much about now, but you do, and people, if you'll please not take this amiss, people of your generation do. I'm talking about Lovecraft.
Howard Phillips Lovecraft. The man whose story so inspired me. About 5 years later, when I was 15, I'd been reading in the same magazine, Weird Tales, a number of his stories, and I also read in the Reader's Column about stories that I had missed that had been published prior to the time I read the magazine. I didn't know how to get a hold of them, because remember, in this antediluvian age, there were no paperbacks or no hardcover reprints, really, of very many fantasy stories available. And once a story had appeared, went out on the stands, it vanished forever. So I wrote my first fan letter in care of Weird Tales to Lovecraft, asking whether or not he knew where I could obtain some of these back issues of his stories. And he responded immediately. He said that he was moving, and he had just done an inventory not only of his stories, but of his fantasy library. He sent me a list of his stories, said I'd be glad to lend you any of these stories, copies of them for you to read, and any book in my library. Well, this was just amazing to me as a 15-year-old kid living in the Middle West that this great author from the East would condescend to answer my letter and make so generous an offer. So I took him apart. I read several of the stories, and we corresponded for, several months. And then he, in one of his letters, said, it occurs to me that perhaps you might be interested in trying your hand at writing some of this material yourself. If you want to do so, I'd be very glad to read the stories and tell you what I think of them.
Oh, brother.
Now, this, of course, was seventh heaven to me. So I took him up on that. I sent him two or three of my efforts. He had inspired me to do this. I hadn't thought of it before. And he didn't criticize. He complimented. That's just what I needed. It was just a shot in the arm. The upshot of it was that when I graduated from high school at 17, I decided to try my hand at writing professionally, and 6 weeks later I'd sold my first story to Weird Tales. That's how it began. But for a period of 4 years there, I was in constant correspondence with this very warm, generous, outgoing person who has a reputation today of being a recluse, but in actuality had more friends, I think, in the fantasy field than anyone I've ever known.
I read that he had hundreds of people he corresponded with regularly.
Yes, indeed, and the group of writers that he had championed and acted as mentor for became known as the Lovecraft Circle.
What did you do with his letters?
I still have them, each and every one of them. They're very, very carefully preserved, believe me.
You know, it's a very strange thing. There are things that are almost cliches in fandom, but they're very beautiful sayings. Like, for instance, the one that we've heard many times about Bob Block. He's such a wonderful, sweet fellow. He has the heart of a child. It's in a glass jar on his desk. Now, there's another phrase that goes with Lovecraft that I think is, it's one line that just describes Lovecraft, in my estimation, perfectly. H.P. Lovecraft is the man who made the grass a little greener on the cemetery side of the wall.
Oh, yes. That used to be ascribed to Robert Graves.
I believe it was. I've always liked that.
You excuse me, got interested in fandom, but you went into it sort of the other way. You went from working with professionals, Lovecraft, Derleth, E. Hoffman Price, Ray Palmer, or Ray Nelson, rather, into fandom, right?
I had published two stories in fan magazines prior to being professionally accepted, but remember, this was during the Depression. And to people that are interested in science fiction today, people that go to conventions, people who travel all around the country, it's probably amazing to realize that in that Depression time, nobody traveled. Literally, no one traveled. They couldn't afford to, unless they actually hopped freight cars. Once in a while, they would band together. Four or five fans happened to live in the same city. And they heard that there was going to be a meeting, because there were no conventions in those days as such. They heard there was going to be a meeting in some other city. They might all pool their resources, and between the five of them raise $18 or $20, and set out in a car and go to this convention with their sleeping bags, or rather this gathering. But for most of us, particularly those of us who were sequestered in the Middle West, there was absolutely no contact except through correspondence. And we were very, very much interested in knowing some of these people, writers and fans whose work we had read in magazines or letters we'd read in the readers' columns. And it was a strange sort of an existence. So I was very much interested in fandom, the little mimeograph fan magazines that came out occasionally, brought news of happenings in the great real world outside. It was quite something.
Many years ago, to give you an idea of, we talk of his fantastic writing in the Gothic field and other fields, but also we have not mentioned the fact of his tremendous sense of humor. And I was aware of it the very first time that I met Bob. I believe we had corresponded a bit before you came out here. And this was in the Depression days. And Bob, in the field, I think you were just getting started in writing a bit. And in those days, if a person was doing any writing, whether you sold one story or two, the nicest thing you could say to him is, "Have you sold anything lately?" That gives him an opportunity to say, "Oh, yes, I sold something to Astounding." Well, Bob came in on the train, and I was the only person here in L.A. that was able to get down to the train to meet him. So when he stepped off the train, we exchanged greetings, and naturally I said, "Good to see you, Bob." I said, "Have you sold anything lately?" And he says, "Yeah, just before I left, I sold my typewriter and my car."
When you came out here, you got into L.A. fandom, and you had people like Henry Kuttner, Robert Heinlein, Ray Bradbury. Whatever happened to those kids?
I've often wondered, but of course, you know, people of that vintage, of that generation, just disappeared.
Yeah, too bad. Real promising, some of them.
They missed out on the Geritol somehow.
What was L.A. fandom like in the 40s?
Well, now I'll tell you. I'd come out here. The meeting that you're talking about occurred in 1937. I came out to visit Henry Kuttner, who'd been a correspondent and a friend of mine. And I stayed with him for 5 weeks at his home, the invitation of his mother. And at that time, he lived in Beverly Hills. And we met on that occasion, Forrest Ackerman, the members of Last Boss fandom, which met at Clifton's Cafeteria downtown.
The one with the waterfall.
The one with the waterfall, where you paid what you could for your meals at that time. This, again, was the Depression, you know. And they had, as I recall, goldfish in the waterfall. Those couldn't pay for a meal, would just scoop up a few fish and bring their own bread. And we met at that time Fritz Leiber, who had not published, was living out here and working in films. He had appeared in Camille. He had doubled for John Barrymore in the dueling sequences of Romeo and Juliet. A few things like that. But he was interested in writing, and he corresponded with Lovecraft during the last months of his life. We also met a young lady who came out with her girlfriend for the first time to the coast, a young lady named Catherine Moore, C.L. Moore. And she and Henry immediately hit it off together, and of course we were married several years later. But amazingly enough, this was our first contact way back in 37. But my impression of the meetings in those days is that they were rather formal. and a little bit self-conscious, because once a group of fans gathered together in the confines of Clifton's cafeteria, it was them against the world. There was nobody else who cared or understood about this kind of writing in those days. It was very, very much an underground movement. Didn't have social approval, critical approval, or financial prestige. And in the 40s, it came out, as Walt mentions, to the second Los Angeles convention, the Pacificon, and I think there were 150 people present on that momentous occasion. I sat on the platform between Lee Brackett and Ray Bradbury, listening to Van Vogt speak, and it was my first attendance at the convention, the first time I had a chance to get up and insult everybody. I didn't come back here again until 59. Well, then I moved out here and immediately got in contact with Last Pass and found that it was an entirely different organization. It was an organization of science fiction fans in an atmosphere where science fiction had already been recognized. There were plenty of paperbacks, movies had been made, films and on television, and they had a little more self-confidence. And of course, we all know where Last Pass has gone from that point on.
Yeah, they're in Burbank currently. Mm-hmm. From Clifton's cafeteria to Burbank, with stops along the way.
In only 40 years.
I think they're still working the same library, too. Conventions. You like conventions. You didn't go to Nikon in 39, did you, the first one?
No, I didn't. I couldn't afford it. Nobody could. You know something about Nikon? Again, there were 100 to 125 people there. And they had a banquet. And of that 125 people, only 32 could attend the banquet, because the banquet price was $1. And only 32 could raise the money to attend. So that gives you some idea of what conventions were like in those days. It wasn't actually till 1952 that convention attendance ever topped the 1,000 mark. That was in Chicago, when Hugo Gernsback was present. And nobody was prepared for this thing. I remember that they'd had Will Jenkins scheduled as MC, and he didn't show up. So at the last minute, I had to step in and do the MC job at the banquet, and it was quite an interesting experience, because all of the luminaries were there for the first time, gathered together under one roof in a hotel, which was later demolished. It had been partially demolished by the conventioneers.
I was just going to say, no cause and effect, well, but maybe not.
Well, the same thing had happened in New York a few years later at the Biltmore. When it was finished, they had to call it the re-Biltmore. But this went on.
We'll be getting even for this next week, friends, at the Fantasy Fair. So, what's the worst insult you have ever leveled at a writer? And has it earned you any repercussions? Have they slashed your tires or kidnapped your wife or something like that?
I think it was an occasion in Detroit when Isaac Asimov and I were co-emceeing a convention banquet. And Isaac got up and told about the first story he had written in 1938 or 9 called Marooned Off Vesta. And I turned to Ike and I said, yes, I remember that story very well. But I've got a question for you. He said, what is it? I said, why didn't you quit when you were ahead? Well, he had no answer for that. When Isaac Asimov doesn't have an answer for something, you know you've really scored.
Science fiction fandom, has it changed? I mean, you mentioned before that when you were meeting in Clifton's, it was, you know, it was a very in-group, and it was them against the world. Is it now, because the tube and mass marketing of paperbacks and so forth, has that changed fandom? Obviously, it's changed access to science fiction. Has it changed fandom?
I think it has. It's caused fandom to divide into a variety of splinter groups. At one time, and I speak now of the 30s and 40s, it was possible to be a science fiction fan, buy every magazine that was published each month, read every book, every science fiction novel or collection that came out, attend meetings of a club, if you were lucky enough to live in a city that had a science fiction club, and put out a fan magazine. At one time, I worked out the financial logistics of this, and the total cost was about $75 a year Not only that, for this expenditure, as I say, you knew everything that was going on in the field. You had it in your grasp. But today, it's become such a broad field with such a broad spectrum that fandom, as I say, has splintered. We now have fans who only attend conventions. There are fans that go from convention to convention. I remember years ago talking to E.E. Smith, Doc Smith, and again to Anthony Boucher, both of whom loved science fiction conventions as much as I did. And they were dreaming an impossible dream. In those days, there was a World Science Fiction Convention, a WesterCon out here, a LunaCon in New York, and a MidwestCon, four in the course of a year. And I said, wouldn't it be wonderful if after we retired, we were able to buy a trailer and go from convention to convention, and wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a convention every week somewhere? This has come to pass. Now there is somewhere in the United States a convention, at least one convention, every week of the year. And Bob Tucker is one of the people who's been attending quite a few of those. I last ran into him with Louisville this summer where I was guest of honor at the RiverCon, and he was the postmaster. He was telling me about some of the things he'd seen during the past 6 months. So there are convention fans. Then there are the magazine fans that do nothing but read fan magazines or publish them. And they oftentimes don't read any of the prozines. They aren't interested in the material. They're interested in fandom, per se, and its relationship to the magazines. Then we have the Star Trek fans. Then we have the fans in latter years who are interested in the technical effects of films, like Star Wars and Close Encounters. And they will read the cinema magazines that feature science fiction, but almost exclusively deal with the special effects and the technical effects and the cinematography. Then we have the fans who are collectors. Some of them are, I'm sad to say, not interested in science fiction at all. They're interested in the increasing value of old first editions. And we have the comic book fans who also are interested sometimes in the value of these publications. And we have the people that are only interested in the films themselves. We have the people who are still hardcore readers. And oftentimes, these interests are not congruous. They don't mesh. So there are half a dozen different fandoms. We have the Tolkien fandom, also, and the Society of Creative Anachronisms, and the Georgian Higher Group, and the Conan Group, and the Burroughs, Edgar Rice Burroughs Group, all under the vast umbrella of so-called science fiction fandom, which now includes fantasy.
And just as well, too.
And one thing more. We have 8-year-old fans, as we did have in those days, and we have fans that are rapidly approaching their 80s, like Walt Darty here. And this goes
on.
Which
direction, Walt?
Cautiously.
Cautiously, right.
What was the old gentleman's name? The oldest fan for so many years that always showed up at the conventions. He was in his 90s, I guess.
Yes.
And that Castro, name, wasn't that it?
Adolf DeCastro. Dr. Adolf DeCastro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My God, that's very close to the name that DeCastries, that Liber uses in Our Lady of Darkness.
And very definitely for that reason.
He was a very strong correspondent of H.P. Lovecraft, we were speaking of early, too.
That he was, and also a friend of Ambrose Bierce, with whom he collaborated on a book called The Monk and the Hangman's Daughter.
Hoo-hoo.
So that's how far back Adolf DeCastro goes.
When you were talking about the fans and the convention, it occurred to me, well, let me check it out first. Was Robert Heinlein in the vicinity when you had that talk with Boucher and
No, Tucker? He was not.
Well, there goes my theory. I was thinking that the man who traveled in elephants, that fantasy that Heinlein wrote,
yes,
was tied in with that, because that sounds...
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. That for those of you who may not remember, that was a story about a couple who retire and who travel across the country visiting county fairs and circuses, and there's a little bit more, but I don't want to spoil the story. It's one of Heinlein's nicest fantasies.
I think anyway. Bob Heinlein was around the club in 40, 41 for about 2 years.
Gonna ask
before
about
he graduated
that.
Away.
Were you in the group then? I mean, what sort of a fan was Heinlein? Or was he?
Heinlein, being an ex-naval officer, and I mean this in the very nicest form, he was an officer and a gentleman. And as a result, some of the fans that he would get around, he just couldn't quite take some of their antics and so forth. He's ready at the drop of a hat to sit around and talk science fiction with you and so forth. But the minute that you get, I don't mean that you That's couldn't drop call him Bob needle, or Walt. Something, but you start calling him Bobsy or something like that, he made no objection, but it's obvious that he didn't like it. But a wonderful, wonderful chap and a good sense of humor. I drove back to Denver, I think that's 42, wasn't it?
I believe so, yes.
I drove back to Denver with Bob and his wife, and we're crossing the desert. He's guest of honor at the convention. And I said, I waited till we got way out here in the middle of the desert, Bob. I said, to tell you something so you could just dump me out of the car if you wanted to. I said, you know, we've known each other for quite a while, been friends and so forth, but I said, frankly, I've never read one of your stories yet. And instantly he came right back and he says, yeah, he says, I'm aware of that. And he says, I imagine that's why we're such damn good friends.
I hope you remedied that. Either that or it was
definitely.
A long walk to Denver.
Very definitely.
You also, in Milwaukee, you wrote radio. And that's something that I am doing. And I'm. Would you like to write radio now, or you want to stick with television movies where the bucks are?
Well, I don't really know whether or not I could write radio now. It's become much more sophisticated. As I recall it, those days were still fairly primitive when it came to radio drama. And it calls for a definite expertise, as you know. I'd have to learn all over again, because that was quite a while ago. But I did a lot of it.
I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm going to apologize in advance. Is there a chance that you have some old radio scripts that we might possibly do here?
I have been asked that repeatedly. I've also been asked whether there were any discs available of the show that I did, Stay Tuned for Terror. In fact, scarcely a week goes by that I don't get a letter from someone. I never got those discs because they were really huge transcription platters. And, of course, I didn't have any equipment to play them, so I didn't make any particular effort to get them. And somewhere in the course of many moves, my copies of those scripts vanished, along with a number of other things. I don't think the movers stole them. They preferred to steal my mystery magazines. That's where their tastes lay. They were into mysteries. But somehow those scripts just vanished. And I think it's a merciful thing, frankly, because my recollection is that they weren't up to par. They wouldn't be today.
That lets us segue very nicely into yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Whence came the idea and the interest in Leather Apron Jack?
I got interested in Jack the Ripper merely because there was such a general reaction and response whenever anyone ever mentioned that name. And I got an idea for a story. I wrote the story, which was called Yours Truly, Jack the Ripper, and thought nothing of it, except that by a peculiar concatenation of circumstances, it appeared just prior to the time when 20th Century Fox was making a film of Mrs. Belloc Lowndes' 1912 novel, The Lodger, starring Laird Krieger. And somehow they had seen it in the magazine, and they wanted to publicize it. One of the big radio shows at that time was the Kate Smith Hour. So they hired Laird Krieger to appear on the Kate Smith Hour in a dramatization of Yours Truly, Jack the Ripper, which was written, at least in part, by H.L. Gold, Horace Gold, who later became the editor of Galaxy and was into radio at that time. It appeared, and from that time on it was printed and reprinted and done on, I suppose, a dozen different radio shows, and it eventually ended up in television, that sort of thing. It's still being reprinted today, but I don't know why that story continued to fascinate people, but it did. I suppose I'd just struck a nerve. There are certain figures, Jung would call them archetypes, that have become a part of our culture, or lack of culture, and Jack the Ripper is one of them. He seemed to symbolize all that was mysterious and evil in an era when everything was supposed to be sedate and proper.
And then you and Harlan teamed up to do a reprise of that story and a collaboration.
Well, several things had happened. I'd been first asked to do a variation of it for Star Trek, which I did.
Called Wolf in the Fold.
That's right. Then Harlan called when he was going to do Dangerous Vision and said, would you do me a story about Jack the Ripper in the future? And I did.
Prowler at the City and the Edge of Forever.
No, my story is the one that I'm referring to, Toy for Juliet.
Toy for Juliet, his
one. And after he received it, he called and said, would you mind if I did a sequel to that story? Which he promptly did. And since that time, of course, we've recorded both stories on an album which is, plus yours truly, Jack the Ripper, an album which is poetically titled Blood. And I don't know whether or not I'm through with Jack or...
Going to ask you about that. First
forever.
Of all, let me say, this is KPFK Los Angeles, Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored radio, and we are Hour 25. Our guest tonight, Robert Block and Walt Dougherty. And Robert Block, we're going to be opening up the phones in a few minutes, and Robert Block is also going to be the guest of honor at the Pasadena Fantasy Fair, which is at the Pasadena Hilton, the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th of September. That's next weekend. And Walt Dougherty, who is a longtime friend of Bob's and a longtime L.A. fan, and I guess I could say BNF, right? Big name fan and personality. I mean, Dougherty isn't that big, but it depends on the type size you can get. And Walt is going to be the MC. Okay. Now, I know you've been asked this 1,000 times. I'm not going to apologize because I've never asked it to you. I know that Psycho is based on a true case that happened in Wisconsin. What was it?
It was the Ed Gein or Ed Gein case. And this was a murder that occurred in a small town, about 30 miles away from a small town where I was living. I didn't have an automobile. I didn't get over there. My little town published a weekly paper, which had a set policy of not offending everyone or anyone. So it merely mentioned this case, but from the Milwaukee papers that I saw, I got some notion that this was a rather peculiar affair. Because this man, middle-aged man, lived in this little community, which was called Plainfield, all of his life. He knew everybody. Everybody knew him. He did babysitting for the neighbor's children. He was very generous during deer hunting season. He would bring around gifts of liver and that sort of thing to other people.
And
one day, a lady who ran a store, I believe it was a hardware store in town, turned up missing. And somebody connected a visit from a customer. The customer was Ed Gein. They went out to his place and they found in the shed this lady hanging upside down, dressed out like a deer. They went into the house. They discovered a certain number of artifacts around, such as a little mason jar filled with human noses.
Good God.
There were certain things in the refrigerator which made the neighbors wonder whether or not their gifts of liver had been all that welcome. And they found out that the adjacent graveyard, had been rifled and bodies had been dug up. So Mr. Gein was spirited off without a trial to the Central Hospital for the Insane, where he resided for some while. Those were all the details that I had at the time. But one thing fascinated me. How could this man who lived in this community all his life get away with something like that without anyone knowing? Because I lived in a town at that time, 1,241 people. The name of the town was Waiwiga, which is an Indian word for sanitary washrooms. And I know that if I sneezed on the south side of town, someone on the north side said a good Sunday. They knew everything that went on.
Sort of a U-turn with the mayor.
You betcha. So how could this possibly occur? And I said, there's a story here. There's got to be a story. So I began to construct this man in my own mind. I said, well, if he committed these murders, wouldn't it be interesting if he didn't know it? Maybe he was a split personality. Maybe he was schizoid. And he'd have amnesic fugues after these murders. Well, what would motivate him? Well, what if he had a mother fixation? A silver cord. His mother had died, but he couldn't let go of her. And all of a sudden, the story was off and rolling. And then I got the notion, what if he was a transvestite? Transvestites weren't all that popular or well-known in those days. And
popular.
And it was considered to be a drag. So the thing was... is that I introduced that. It wasn't until some years later when I was asked to do a fact article on the Gein case for an anthology or Mystery Writers of America, that I ransacked around, got some material from people that had covered the case, and discovered that I was much closer than I thought. Gein was a transvestite.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
He didn't dress up in women's clothing. He dressed up in the skin of the women that he had killed and a pair of breasts and paraded around in it. He did have a mother fixation. His mother had died, left him alone. He indulged in things that my character didn't indulge in, such as necrophilism and cannibalism. And he was far worse. The poor man was in a state of fugue, amnesic fugue. I understand that he was up for parole or pardon or release about a year ago in Wisconsin. They decided to keep him incarcerated. He's now in his late 60s. He's perfectly harmless. It's a tragic sort of a thing, and I tried to convey the pity and horror of this thing, as well as the shocking, shivery side of it when I wrote the book.
Did Hitchcock do it justice?
I think he did a superlative job with that. Of course, I'm happy that it's all the book. It's 90% just as the book was. He expanded on certain scenes, but he didn't change the plot. He downgraded the age of the central character, Norman Bates, but did so very, very happily because it enabled him to cast Anthony Perkins in the role. Who I think Perkins did a wonderful job.
Yeah.
So I would say that for a writer, this is a great thrill to have someone like that really put his work up on the screen.
He complimented you.